The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, my time-travelling friends. It's Sarah here, and I'm back with yet another episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Now, before we get deep into this month's episode, it's just time for me to say welcome to June, and we are approaching midsummer. As you well know, May and June, two of my favourite months in the year, and I can't believe we're here already. I must admit, I'm looking forward to this month because at the end of the week, in just a few days' time, I'll be packing my suitcases and heading off on a two-week vacation or holiday to South Wales, notably South West Wales this time. Yes, I'm going to be exploring both Carmarthenshire and Pembrokeshire. Now, the latter, of course, has deep connections with early Tudor history and with Henry VII. And I look forward to exploring and doing a couple of podcast recordings, first of all at Pembroke Castle and secondly at St David's Cathedral. All very interesting. I get that frisson of excitement whenever I'm going to a new location that I haven't explored before. I can't wait to tell you all about it. So stay tuned for those podcasts. They, in fact, probably will not be coming your way until early next year. But of course, if you are on social media, then the best place to be is to be following me, The Tudor Travel Guide, on Instagram, because I post there almost daily. And certainly when I'm on the road, I will keep you updated with all the latest. So maybe I'll see you there. Well, there's no more notices today, so it is time to just get straight on with today's show. Well, last summer, in fact, I headed to Leicestershire. As you may well know, I am very intrigued by Cromwell, his history, and of course, being the Tudor Travel Guide, the properties and locations associated with him and his family. Sadly, while Cromwell's family homes around London, such as the one at Stepney and also his home in Austin Friars, are long, long gone, one of his country properties survives. Now, as I've mentioned, this is Laund Abbey in Leicestershire, and it was acquired by Cromwell through the spoils of the dissolution. And although he never lived there, as we will hear, he did visit, though, his son, Gregory Cromwell, made Laund his home and, in fact, is buried in the chapel there. Well, that was enough to get my pulse quickened and my desire for wanting to know more certainly heightened. So I headed up to Leicestershire and I met with our guest today, Peter Liddell, who is an expert on Laund Abbey. So without further ado, my friends, I give you Laund Abbey and Peter Liddell. So hello, dear listeners. Welcome to this episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. And today you find me in Leicestershire at a building that I've wanted to come and explore for a long time now. If you've been following the Tudor History and Travel Show, you will know that I have a particular interest in Thomas Cromwell and Thomas Cromwell's properties. And Laund Abbey, of course, has a very direct connection with the Cromwell family. And we're going to be hearing all about that in a moment from our expert today, Peter Liddell. I'll be introducing Peter in a moment. But first, I just wanted to say hello to Alison Meyer.
Hello.
Hello there. Welcome. And thank you for inviting us here today to look around this glorious building.
You're very welcome. Well loved by many people.
Maybe before we get into the history of the building with Peter, you could just explain to us where we are and what Laund Abbey is all about today.
Laund Abbey was given to the Diocese of Leicester in 1957 as a gift to be used for ministry, for priests to come and live here and learn. And we've carried on some of the legacy of the Augustinian Priory that was here 900 years ago by working with ministers and priests. And beyond that, anybody who would like to take some time out to find a reflective space, a space of sanctuary, based around a praying community that, of course, has its roots in that Augustinian Priory, but also through the Tudor manor house and country house era, which I'm sure you'll say more about
in a moment.
When the chapel, the original, one of the side chapels of the original priory became the house chapel. There's been prayer here and a praying community of some kind for all of that time in some way. And there is now a praying community here today, a rhythm of prayer that takes place here. And that prayer is the heart of what we do. So we offer hospitality through the cafe. Anyone can come and visit the cafe.
And you certainly do. I have to say that I arrived here. I was totally unaware there was a tea room. And again, anybody who's listening to this will probably be smiling now because they know one of my fixations is to enjoy history with tea and cake.
Absolutely.
And on that, Laund delivers. So I was surprised, actually, because I knew it was a retreat centre, but I didn't know it was open to the public. I mean, not the building itself, but you can come along and enjoy the kind of grounds.
You can come and enjoy the grounds, use the cafe. You can book in for meals, and although we run our own programme of retreats and we have groups who use us for retreats, we can also we also have individuals who come. So actually anybody can come and book a room if they like the special atmosphere of this place.
Oh, how wonderful.
And come and stay in one of the rooms that is part of the original house.
That's wonderful.
And who knows who would have been there before?
Maybe Gregory Cromwell's bedroom himself.
Absolutely.
Now, if people want to find out more about visiting, where should they go to?
Our website is the good first port of call, and that will say something about the range of things we do and give a link for booking and also the hours of opening of the cafe. And our Facebook page is probably a good place for really up-to-date information.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So I'll put some links in the description associated
That's
with
great.
The podcast so people will be able to follow on from there. Thank you so much for giving us that quick intro. So with that, dear listeners, I would like to introduce our expert guide today. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Welcome to the Tudor History and Travel Show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, first of all, before we get into the history of this glorious place, perhaps you could just introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm Peter Little. I was Leicester County Council's senior archaeologist. I'm an honorary visiting fellow at the School of Archaeology and Ancient History at the University of Leicester, which is a mouthful.
It is.
Which means I'm retired really, but still keep my hand in with archaeology. So I'm involved in excavations and various things, mostly through the university. But I've been interested in this place for quite a long time.
Have you? What first caught your attention about Laund?
Well, I was looking at all the abbeys and priories of Leicestershire for an article that I was writing, and I got here and found a very welcoming community here who wanted to know more about their history. So we were able to bring students here to do geophysical survey, which gave us an idea of what was happening around the standing buildings, which is really helpful. Mm-hmm. And we've then gone on from there. There's been building works since where there's been archaeological observation of what's going on. And, you know, my colleagues at the university and other archaeologists have been involved in that, but I've kept close eye on what's happening.
I see. So maybe I'll just cut to the chase for those people who are listening and maybe have not heard of Laund Abbey before, because I must admit, until a sort of maybe a year or two ago, neither had I. But I have, as I've just been mentioning, a bit of a fascination about Thomas Cromwell, and particularly, of course, being the Tudor travel guide, the places he owned. And that's how Laund first came onto the radar for me. Now, the reason I'm particularly here, of course, is that Laund was passed to his son Gregory, and Gregory is in fact interred in the chapel here with a glorious monument, and that's what we are going to go and see and talk about and explore.
Absolutely, yes.
But before we do that, I always like to start big and then narrow in. So there are people listening to the podcast who are less familiar with English geography, so perhaps you could tell us where in the world we are, and then maybe describe this fantastic and beautiful landscape that we're standing in at the moment.
Right, well, we're in Leicestershire, and Leicestershire is in the East Midlands, and we are in the eastern part of Leicestershire. So just over the hill is Rutland. So we're quite close to the board, Leicestershire-Rutland border. We're in an area that in the medieval period was predominantly wooded, and as you look around the landscape, there's still an awful lot of trees. So this was part of the Royal Forest of Leicestershire. The site of the priory, as it was in the medieval period, because it only got upgraded to being an abbey when the Cromwells took it over, and it sounds grander to live in an abbey than a priory. So Lawn Priory was part of Loddington Parish, and Loddington is the village over the hill in the other direction to Rutland. And it's a fabulous site. It's in a sort of natural bowl, you know. You almost like a massive amphitheatre with this sitting in the middle of it, which is fabulous. It's, you know.
Coming over here in the car, I'm obviously with Chris, my partner and sound man today, as well as my sister who's gate crashing this podcast recording today. She's visiting. But I said, I want to feel what Thomas Cromwell felt when he came to Lawnd and decided on the dissolution that Lawnd was for him. And I can see it here because, as you say, this is fantastic, beautiful parkland dotted with mature trees, oak trees, I guess many of them. And then right in the centre, the original priory would have been, of course. Today, the house is what? When was the house that we see in front of us today actually built?
Well, there are bits of it that go right back to the priory. But the facade that we're seeing in front of us is probably about 1600.
Right.
So this is just after the Cromwells have left.
Mm.
You know, the next owners, or the next but one owners, we're not quite sure who did it, sort of remodelled the house.
Mm.
So the house that the Cromwells fashioned out of the remains of the priory looked much more like the priory than the house that we see today was.
Yes.
Because they have made use of an awful lot of the buildings and just repurposed them as a house.
So is the front that we see almost like a facade? Do you think that the original Tudor house is behind there, or did they really do a full reconfiguration? Do we know that?
I suspect that wing there,
over to our right,
and it's a sort of an H-shaped mansion.
Mm.
I suspect that wing there incorporates quite a lot of priory fabric, probably, at least further down the building.
Mm.
So I think that we are now standing in the cloister of the priory. So if we were here, before the Cromwells got hold of this, the church would have been running up this side here.
All the way along on my left-hand side as I face the building.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you always know in a abbey or priory that if you know where the church is, you know where the refectory is, because that's on the opposite side of the cloister. So I think this is a cut-down version of the refectory block ran all the way through to the ha-ha, which is behind us. Now, ha-ha, in case people don't know, is a wall concealed in a ditch. It's to give the illusion from the house that you have an unbroken vista of nature in front of you, whereas in fact there's a ditch that stops the sheep coming in and nibbling the flowers.
Yes,
and leaving
their messages all over the ground.
Yeah. So we think that the western range is sitting. Well, we're probably just on the edge of it, because there was a tiny little excavation in here when they were going to put a statue in, that found a wall running
right close to where we're standing now.
Yeah. So we think that block, whatever it was, and they're always more difficult to know what the sort of western side of the cloister is going to be, ran across there. And then the eastern side, which would be the dormitory block on the first floor and cellars underneath and a chapter house there, would be over there.
And that's where the house, the actual main
house
is standing
now.
Today.
So there are two possibilities. One is that the block we see is actually just the remodelled dormitory block of the priory. Or the back wall of this is an original priory wall. And then as they've remodelled the house, they've built
forward
on the other side.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So I've got a couple of things I think you could really help with. Before we get into talking about the Cromwells, and clearly that's our focus today, and seeing Gregory Cromwell's tomb. Nevertheless, a couple of things I want to cover off. I think it would be really helpful if you could just summarise. You've started to do that here, but maybe just summarise for everybody how an abbey or a priory is normally laid out. It will help people whenever they go to a religious building or ruin, how to navigate and find their way around it.
Right. Well, luckily they're all built to a pretty much a standard plan. So you have a church on one side of the cloister. The cloister is the big open square in the middle, which can be laid out as a garden or a courtyard or whatever, often with nearly always with a covered walkway running around the outside of it, the cloister walk. On one side or the other, and it's not fixed, is the church. So that's either on the north side or the south side, because it's an east-west running building, and that's what churches
are. And that's always fixed, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always east-west. Yeah. But you can have it on either side. Nunneries tend to have it more often on one side than the other, which is nobody quite knows why. But so one side the church, and then running from the east side, you get the dormitory with the chapter house underneath the dormitory. So they are often sort of semi-sunken buildings there. And they're sort of next to the church in that range. The dormitory is close to the east end of the church, because as part of the seven offices of the church, seven services through the day, one of those is in the middle of the night. So you are roused from your bed by a bell, and I'm never quite sure how they know when the time is right to ring the bell, because they haven't got a watch
the sundial,
to do
it. Have they? No, the sun's not
3
up.
In the morning, it's difficult to have a sundial. Yeah. They are roused from their bed, they troop down into the church, they have a service, and then they get back to bed for a couple of hours. So it's very, there's a night stare that takes you from the dormitory into the church for that office. And then at the other end of the dormitory, the third side is the refectory, often with a warming house as well, because these things were not centrally heated.
And refectory, of course, is for eating.
Refectory is eating, yes.
Yeah.
Just as the dormitory is for sleeping, yeah. So, and then the kitchen in the corner. And then the west range, if you've got the church on the north side, often has the abbot's lodging in it, so the abbot is often in there, at least early on, because quite often they build themselves a mansion later which
Didn't start out that way, did it?
No, so, but, other bits and pieces can be in that. And then beyond that, you've got infirmary block, which is what it says on the tin, really. It's where people who are not well enough to go through the seven services a day, and they have better food, they have a chapel there, and for the old and infirm members of the community. Mm-hmm. Then it's not for the wider community, for the religious house community. And then there were brew houses, there were bake houses, there were stables, there were all the other accoutrements of it scattered around the buildings.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much. Because I do find that if you can understand the basic plan, you can find your way around any kind of ruin then, and show off to your friends and go, this must be the chapter house, even if there isn't a sign. So thank you very much for elucidating that.
Thank you.
I think it's important we understand the origins of Laund Abbey.
Right.
Why it was put here, who founded the abbey, and what kind of monastic order lived right. here.
It was founded by a married couple called Richard and Matilda, or Maud Bassett, in the early 1120s, probably. The sign outside says founded 1119, and there was a 900th anniversary celebrations a few years ago, but I think it's a little bit too early.
Okay.
We may well be on the 900th anniversary at the moment, or even next year. And it's quite unusual, actually, for a woman to be noted as a founder, but it turns out that it was her land. She brought it to the marriage. So she gets named, which is as I say, quite unusual. It was an Augustinian house, which was very, very popular in the 1120s. You know, the king was quite keen, Henry II was quite keen on the Augustinian order. So anybody with connections to the court sucked up to the king by founding Augustinian abbeys and priories.
And how did the Augustinians differ from, say, the Cistercians or the Benedictines?
Well, the Benedictines are a little bit earlier, generally, in their foundation. The Augustinians are one of the new orders that were being found at the time. Yeah, Cistercians tended to be very keen on hard work. You know, sort of give us a really rugged place and we'll turn it into something. The Augustinians, they were canons, so they weren't monks. They were canons.
What's the difference?
So they were priests. They were all priests. That you know, the whole community were priests. So, which is different. And these were now white canons, I think. It's the Premonstratensians, I think, who were black canons. And then for 400 years, they were here. They were building up the estate. You know, they were being given bits of land. Obviously, the founders give quite a big chunk of property to support the work of the community. Other people give stuff as you go along. So it built up a big property portfolio, you know, through the period until, of course, we get to the 16th century when we have
Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell.
Thomas
But before we go to those two shady figures, can you give me an idea of how big this priory was, particularly in relation to other Augustinian priories in the country?
I don't think there was ever more than 20 canons here. So it was a sort of medium-sized priory. And of course, round here, there were quite a few religious houses. There was Euston Abbey just over the hill there. There was Brook Priory over the hill in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you tend to get concentrations of abbeys and priories in these sort of woody areas. Partly because communities wanted a secluded spot for prayer and everything else, but also because it's cheap. Give away the bit of your estate to the church that isn't the most productive agricultural land. So, I mean, idyllic scene, as I say. The Bassetts owned Loddington, so this was part of the parish, and the village is right up at the other end of the parish up there.
So let's go forward to the 16th century now and start to touch on the Cromwellian history of Laund. He obviously took Laund, didn't he, at the dissolution. There is a very famous diary entry where he writes, is it myself for Laund?
That's the way I always have seen it, yes.
Yeah.
There's sort of a marginal entry, I think, in there that says yes.
So he'd been here before,
well,
clearly.
We know, there's this strange letter from one of the canons here to him, sending him cheese.
It's a great letter. Do say a little bit more about it.
I think it was called Thomas Frisby, the canon, if I remember correctly. And he was sending him six cheeses and then reminding him that he was the bloke who picked him up when he fell over visiting Laund in the snow. And they'd gone for a walk in the snow and Thomas Cromwell had fallen over, possibly on that going up that hill on the other side there. And he had picked him up. So he wanted to remind him that he'd...
done the good deed.
Yes, because, of course, Thomas Cromwell was the vice-regent of spirituality. So he was the number two in the church after the king. Hmm. So you wanted him on your side if you could. Yeah, so a few cheeses.
I was going to say, six cheeses, obviously.
Because we'd love to know, is what sort of cheese it was.
Yes.
You know, is it Red Leicester? Is it Stilton? Is it, you know?
Well, but
presumably.
Both very fine cheeses, I have to say.
Absolutely, yes. We're very proud of our cheeses.
I do like both of those. They're right at the top of the tree for me. So he had been here before. So he had visited.
So we don't know how many times he came here, because, of course, you know, when he was working for Wolsey, he was in and out of abbeys and priories across the country. So he may well have been here several times, and it may well have just stuck in his memory as something that was a fabulous place to get should the opportunity ever arise.
And of course it did.
Yes. But of course Lorne was very late in the dissolution process, so the commissioners didn't get here till very much the end of 1539. It wasn't till, I think it was even into December 1539, they came here to take the surrender of the house. And, of course, these things were not seized as such. They made them an offer they couldn't refuse.
Indeed.
To come and sign a surrender document which says, we relinquish this to the king. And in return for that, you get a pension. And we have got quite good evidence of all the lists of people who were getting pensions from here, which is paid out of the money that was raised by the sale or continued use of the estates going with these things. And there were people, for 20, 30 years later on, still getting a pension.
So if this was dissolved in 1539, of course, Thomas Cromwell became ennobled.
It was a good year and a bad year from 1540, in that he got to be Earl of Essex. He got Lorne, which was granted in 1540, and then he had his head chopped off.
So
I think that probably soured it for him a little bit.
It probably did. I know he was very concerned about his only surviving child, Gregory. I think he wrote a very grovelling letter to Henry, please be mindful of my son, and obviously don't take it out on them.
Yeah.
What happened?
But of course, Gregory had married Elizabeth Seymour, which really helps when you are married to the sister of the Jane Seymour, of course, who had given birth to Edward, so the heir.
So Gregory is, in fact, Henry VIII's brother-in-law and the uncle to the king-to-be, right?
Absolutely, which really helps you. Yeah. So although most of Thomas Cromwell's estates, I think, are seized by the crown as a traitor, this is confirmed to Gregory. So they continue to have this. And what we don't know really is, at least what I don't know, and I'm sure other people do, is how much other properties Gregory had. He certainly had more interest in this area. He became Baron Cromwell of Oakham, which is the nearest town, but actually in Rutland.
Yeah, right.
Because of course his father's titles didn't come to him.
No, they were severed with his head, right?
Yes, absolutely. And we know that Gregory continued to appear in Parliament on a quite regular basis. So, he wasn't here the whole time, hiding out in the countryside.
Yeah. But I know that, because I'd done a little bit of writing about Gregory, he married Elizabeth at Mortlake, and then they went to Lewis, I think, to establish their marital home, which again was owned by Thomas Cromwell. And then it sounds to me as though the next place that he kind of came to and founded as his home was here at Lorne.
Yes, that's my understanding, yes. Yeah.
And so I'm trying to think what kind of age he would be. He was born about 1520, so he came to Lorne. Was it the early 1540s? Was it shortly after the property was granted to him?
Yes, yeah, I believe so, 1541, I think.
So young, so 21, 22-year-old.
Yes, yeah.
Lad with a growing family.
Very. And has a priory.
And he became, I understand, because I've been doing my little bit of reading, he became a very wealthy landowner, didn't he? Significant landowner in this whole area.
Yes. That's my understanding as well. So it fell to him to convert the priory into a house, because his dad didn't have time. Your head chopped off slows you down considerably.
And I fear I know the answer to this question, Peter, but do we know what he did to the house or anything of what that Tudor house looked like?
Well, yes, I think we do.
Oh, God. I was fearing you were going to say no. It's been lost. That's wonderful.
This is down to All Souls College, Oxford, who were landowners over that hill. I keep pointing at a different hill in each toe. At Watborough, which is the adjoining parish.
I see.
They had that. The village was cleared in 1490s and turned over to sheep pasture, and then was leased to Lord. So their sheep were on Watborough. But when it got to the 1560s, they began to suspect that not all the land they should have was being credited to them. So they sent somebody out to produce a map.
Now, Peter, you're showing me a map, and what I'm going to do, if this is okay with you, if we could reproduce this and put this on a show notes page so people can see what I am looking at.
Yeah, I mean, the original is in All Souls College, Oxford, and it's the most fabulous bit of 16th century historical geography.
Really?
In that what they are trying to do is to reconstruct what was here before, so that they can actually work out what should belong to Watborough and what should belong to Lorne.
I see.
So you see, you know, they say, you know, in here, you know, these fields have formerly been arable, you know, so, you know, the things that are now pasture, and you can see they're recording the ridge and furrow.
So they are.
Yeah, it's fabulous, and there's all sorts of little notes of, you know, crosses in this, you know, all this sort of little details of landscape that we wouldn't know anything about. And you can see Sovey Castle, which was the only royal castle in Leicestershire. Only just, because Rutland was a few yards away. But that was the sort of the headquarters of the forest.
So, I've never heard of it before.
So, Sovey,
how do you
pronounce it? S-A-U-V-E-Y.
Okay.
Yeah. It's an earthwork. There's no buildings left there now.
Right.
We know.
Owned by the Crown?
Well, it had been. It was
in medieval period.
Yes, yeah.
Right.
So when they came hunting in the forest, this is where they would stay.
That's where
and
they would stay.
The Nevilles, who were the foresters, would have it as a base.
Yes. Yeah.
But what I looked at this for an awful long time before I actually started looking at the buildings marked.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start looking, you see that they're all different. And and there are two versions of the map. So there are two versions of the little, what I thought was an icon for the building, but it's actually not an icon for the building. It is actually a little sketch of the house. So you see the front facade there with steps running up. I'm sorry, this is a bit pixelated.
Yes, because it's obviously quite a small image, so you've blown the image up. So it's a bit pixelated.
On the original map, I'm sure it's very clear, but I've never seen the original map.
Yes.
Which is in Oxford. So, mm-hmm. And you can see two wings coming forward.
Yes.
With things coming off on either side.
So it's almost a U shape, isn't there, with a large central courtyard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then what appears to be a fence and a building with a tiled
roof. A kind of a gatehouse
in the centre.
Yes.
So the way I interpret this is that this block here is essentially where that block there, the main block of the present house.
Yes.
And then the two wings coming forward, there are presently two wings, but very truncated.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I suspect that they ran on, and that the open space that we see in the centre there is the cloister.
Yes,
so
right.
So they have sort of repurposed the buildings in quite a cunning way to give yourself a country house out of a priory,
yes.
Which of course they then renamed as an abbey.
Yeah. And the priory church, I presume, essentially taken down?
Well, what we don't know is the real character of the priory church. So I suspect that a lot of it went down. But whether any part of this is, you know, some aisle of the church, if there was an aisle on this side, which I'm beginning to doubt now.
Right.
But, they have used what they could of the fabric to turn it into a mansion. Of course, leaving the chapel at the back as the only, you know, unchanged part of the priory that went through into the house, or abbey as it now was.
So you mentioned the chapel there, Peter, and obviously that's the really the main reason why we're here today. It's that existing part of the Tudor house. It's where Gregory's buried. So I wonder if we just go round there now and maybe have a look at the chapel, go inside and pick up the story of Gregory and where he's buried.
Absolutely.
Let's do it. So we've just come a very short walk around the side of the building and into a sort of a small garden, and you can clearly see the chapel in front of us here. So where was this in relation to the original priory? And can you describe a little bit about that?
We are standing in the main body of the church at the moment.
Right here.
So this is a side chapel. You can see in the fabric here, we have a big circular arch that starts off there on that
very grand pillar.
Bundle of pillars, yes, there. And then it's cut off by the windows up above, but you can see the other side of it there.
Yes.
A pillar built into the wall. So we are standing in the crossing of the church. So it's we're fairly certain we're dealing with a cruciform church, a cross-shaped church.
Right.
And we're standing right in the centre of the cross. With the arms going off either side. So a transept out that side and a transept out that side.
Yeah.
Whether there were aisles originally or even later on, we don't know. But the chancel or presbytery would be up at that end, so the high altar.
Oh, the high altar is to my left there.
Where the cross is there. Uh-huh. There's a little burial ground here. Mm. There's a Bishop of Leicester buried here.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
So
it's a nice quiet spot, I must say.
Yes.
How was originally the chapel that we're about to walk into? How was that? That was related very close to the high end of the
church. It's one of probably two flanking side chapels to the Priory Church. So one or other of them would probably be a lady chapel. You know, would dedicate to the Blessed Virgin Mary. Mm-hmm. But of course, we're not quite sure. We are fairly sure that this chapel, at least in the 15th century, became a chantry chapel for the Chaworth family, who were the descendants of the Bassetts who founded this originally. So they were seen as the founder's family. Okay. And we know from various tombs that are recorded in there, and some of which are still there under the floor.
Really? Oh, a lovely, you're showing me a drawing of a typical kind of brass of a medieval knight and his lady.
Yes, well, that's Thomas and Alice Chaworth from 1450. They would be buried in there. And then there was a priest there, and we know that is there, because when they were putting a chase for an electricity cable, when they were doing the last lot of refurbishment, they found the bottom of...
Of course I can see it,
yeah, yes. You can see exactly what we're looking at. This is from the local historian John Nichols, who is a fabulous source of information from the late 18th, early 19th century, yeah, 8 volumes on Leicestershire history and archaeology from 1795 to 1815.
I love those early historians and antiquarians, they're fantastic.
Sent their artists out to record all these things.
It's get that these days, it's all too expensive.
Yes.
Anyway, shall we go inside and have a look in the chapel? Oh, what a lovely chapel. Of course, this chapel is very much used today, and it's got that feel, hasn't it?
Yes,
it is,
absolutely, yeah. I mean, one of the things that you had to do when you took on a religious house as a private home, you had to have a chapel in it. Mm. So here they've repurposed one that was already here rather than having to build a new one.
Makes a lot of sense.
So the big archway that we see at one end is the way you would have come into this chapel in the medieval period, from the transept there. So you've got that big arch we could see from the outside. There's one side of it there and the other side of it right over there. So it's a huge great arch.
Yes.
So we've now just moved into the transept, which is... Yeah, we can see the fabric of it in the house, so that survives.
Yes.
Yeah, beyond the arch there, we've got the chapel, and right up at the end there is Gregory's memorial.
Well, can you tell us when Gregory died and what did he die of? Do we know?
I think it was the sweating sickness, which is one of these slightly mysterious
things, isn't it?
That carried off Thomas's wife and children.
His two daughters, died, didn't they? So we've got this incredible, and once again, ladies and gentlemen, those of you listening, of course, I'm going to put a picture of this in the show notes page.
Yeah.
It is beautiful, isn't it?
And the inscription says, "Here lieth the body of Gregory Cromwell," and it's always with a U, Knight, Lord Cromwell, who departed this life the
fourth
day of July in the year of our Lord God, 1551. So he had this for 10 years. And when he dies, the Inquisition post-mortem talks about him having the site of the late monastery of Lourdes, barns and everything else, and a bell tower, a campanile, which is interesting. So we wonder if perhaps the church tower has survived the modification of the building into a house.
I see, yes. And this is Nicholas Pesner, who writes a lot, who's sort of wandered around England writing about his various historic monuments. He's particularly taken by this, isn't he?
And he says it's one of the finest Renaissance monuments in the country, and I think he's probably right.
Can we try and have a go at describing what we can see? I mean, how big is it, would you say, scale-wise? What do we think?
Ooh, I don't know.
No.
Possibly 10 feet. I mean, it starts off with a pediment on the top, with then a few figures up above that. And then we got into the monument proper, which has at the centre the a helm, a helmet showing that he was a knight, and then either side winged horses. And then we've got, I'm not sure what that's supposed to be. Do you think that's a sort of breastplate or something, or a fancy coat of arms with lions on it? But
I wonder if this is Gregory's, is this his coat of arms? The chevrons with the four lions on it.
I don't know, but...
I'll have to look up that. That's going to be one of my little bit of homework when I go home, to have a look at Gregory Cromwell's crest. And you also have the motto, don't you, somewhere? So
faire mon devoir.
Do my work. Do my duty. My duty. That would make a lot of sense.
And then below that, we've got another couple of cheruby figures holding
a scroll. It looks like it once had something in the middle of it, but...
It ought to have something, oughtn't it?
It doesn't, and you can see this, it's almost scored as if something was affixed to it.
They were going to put something in it, so maybe that was going to be for when Elizabeth died, and they were going to add her on at the bottom there. That's often what happens.
Ah, interesting.
In old tombs, but...
And of course, she actually went on and outlived him by many years and married...
Right. Right into the 1590s, wasn't it?
She married well, didn't she? I think it was William Paulet's eldest son, the Marquess of Winchester. So she's actually buried at Old Basing. Another tomb to add to your list, ladies and gentlemen. Certainly on my list. And frustratingly, you know, I've been to Old Basing many, many times, and I've never noticed her tomb. So I need to go back. But I'm imagining that his body is buried in a vault as opposed to being under there. Do we know that?
We don't. That is my guess as well, that somewhere very close to here will be a vault. I mean, again, the old ground probing radar would be able to pick that
Indeed.
Up probably. But.
And I seem to remember also that his son, I think Henry, so it would be Thomas Cromwell's grandson, is also buried here at Laund as well.
Yes. Mm. That's my understanding.
Yes. Wow. Those vaults always amazed me because once they were, you know, like the one in Westminster Abbey for Henry VII and Elizabeth of York, you can't see where the entry point is.
No. It's only... Well, they weren't built to keep
to
going
go
back.
In down. Yes.
Up in the windows here, yeah, the top lights there, they are medieval, so... You can see the difference, I think, between the 19th century
yes,
glass and the medieval glass. So, a whole lot of saints around the top, and somewhere, I think, there's Chaworth coats of arms.
But... And that's it. They're beautifully preserved, aren't they?
Yes, they are. You don't see that amount of medieval glass. I mean.
Is it particularly renowned, Laund, for that?
I don't think so. I don't think people know. The next place over, Withcote Hall, there's some fabulous glass supposed to have been made by Henry VIII's glassmaker.
Oh, is that? I know of that, but I didn't realise it was so close.
Yes, it is literally just down the road. And, of course, one of the panels was stolen a year or two ago. Yeah. They just came in and took a panel. I've been worrying they might come back and steal more.
But. And is Withcote open to the public, or is that a private chapel? Or?
It's often open. I have wandered into it without actually asking anybody, so I don't know whether... Mm. I've spoken to the owners as I've gone by, so they've not turned a hair.
Okay. So they're probably used to people just turning up and wandering in and having a look at their glorious glass. So is there still... You said a panel was stolen. Is there still some glass left?
Oh, yes. Yes, most of it is there, but one has gone. There's just a bit of hard... Well, last time I went, there was a bit of hardboard in the
So sad, isn't it? There's been some nasty... thefts around Tudor historic artefacts in recent times, including Mary Queen of Scots prayer beads from Arundel, I should say.
Really?
Oh, Arundel Castle got pinched as well. So, all told, the Cromwells owned Laund for, what, about, I think, about 60 years, isn't it? Something like that. So, not a long time.
No, it's the late 1590s, I think, and then their focus moves on to other places. And it sold twice quite rapidly around 1600, 1610 to the Smiths and the Halfords have it. And we think that the house as we see it, remodeled, is probably from that sort of time.
Right.
But one thing that I just show you that might be of interest, if we just go through the transept.
I'm using my imagination.
Yes. So we're still in the transept, but if we just look here, and if you look up, we've got a door which has been, I think, punched through this wall, probably by the Cromwells. Probably not personally, but they probably had somebody who did it for them. If you look at the top, the shape of it suggests a 16th century arch. But the interesting thing is, down here is a slot for a locking bar. Suggests that this is an external door which has been punched through the transept. Yeah, there's not the thing that you would have in a priory. But it goes into nothing.
How curious.
There is nothing there. And the it suggests, I mean, if you realise, they put in a lift here, because the chapel is at a completely different level to the rest of the house. Mm-hmm. They have mucked around with the levels here. At some point, somebody has filled in a lot of the front there. So,
Gosh, it's a really Higgledy-piggledy, isn't it now?
Yeah, so I don't fully understand what's going on.
No.
I guess I never will.
That makes two of us.
Yeah. That's just a little mystery, which And when you go into the cellars further down, there's a nice 16th or very early 17th century window in the cellar, opening to nothing, suggesting, as I say, that the levels have really been changed.
Mm. Okay. Well, I think that brings us to the end of our story. Thank you so much for being our guide here and illuminating the history of Laund Abbey for us. Thank you, Peter.
I know, it's a great pleasure. I love Laund. I like to talk about it.
Oh, so that's great. Well, a lot more people are going to find out about it now, so thank you again.
Right, no, pleasure.
Well, that's a huge thank you from me to the staff at Laund Abbey and, of course, our expert today, Peter Liddle, for sharing his depth of knowledge and research on the property. I hope it's inspired you to head off a little off the usual tourist trail and to seek out this most idyllic and peaceful of locations and maybe sit and enjoy a cup of tea and a slice of cake while you ruminate on the life of the incredible Cromwells. That's all from me from this episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. As ever, it's been a pleasure to go time travelling with you. And of course, I will see you on the virtual road again next month. Do stay tuned, of course, as I mentioned at the top of this programme, for all my adventures, which I'll be posting on Instagram as I head off on holiday to take, yes, a quite well-deserved break, I hope. And also, of course, I will along the way be exploring just one or two wonderful Tudor locations. Which reminds me, lovely members, don't forget we have a community board, and as well as posting on Instagram, I also regularly post to the board, giving you some behind-the-scenes stuff that's going on and some of my latest developments, thinking, places I've explored, photos, etc. Well, that's a little bit of a postscript for this episode, but do make sure you check out that board, and if you're not already, join, please do. I'd love to see you there. Right, it really is time now to go, so have a wonderful month, and I'll see you on the virtual road again very, very soon. Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, it's happy time travelling!